And first up, State versus, is it Mallett?
I think it's Mallett.
Mallett.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Monic Mistry. I'm here on behalf of Ms. Mallett, and I'd like to reserve 5 minutes.
Okay.
This case involves a charge of rendering criminal assistance. Ms. Mallett was in a car driven by Josh Blake when Mr. Blake shot a Washington State Patrol trooper. She was charged under 9A76050, and the specific prong that she was charged with was harboring or concealing a person who was wanted by the police or thought to have committed a crime. And the analysis here begins with the Budik case, the Supreme Court's case addressing a different prong of this statute. In this case, we're talking about harboring or concealing, which by those plain terms seem to call for some action or conduct, not mere words. But under Budik, even mere words do not qualify for a rendering conviction if they are nothing more than a false disavowal of knowledge. And that's what we have here at the most.
Are you arguing that if the concealment takes the form of a misrepresentation, deception of the police, that the same analysis in Budik must apply?
Yes. Yes. So the false disavowal of knowledge is insufficient. And what we had here is Ms. Mallett saying that she had not been with Mr. Blake, that she had not seen Mr. Blake, and she didn't know anything about a shooting. So those comments altogether show a false disavowal of knowledge.
And he had not been in the house.
She didn't say he had not been in the house. She had not seen him in the house. She was asked if she had seen him in the house, and she said no.
Is that an affirmative misrepresentation?
I would say no. If she had said he has not been in the house, that would be closer. But saying I have not seen him is the kind of a false disavowal that the courts have accepted as a mere false disavowal of knowledge that that does not qualify as rendering.
I guess the other main question then is, what about her false alibi?
Well, the false alibi was for herself, not for Mr. Blake. She didn't say Mr. Blake was with me moving or anything like that. She said I was in Belfair. I wasn't in the car with him. I don't know if she said I wasn't in the car with him, but I was in Belfair moving.
But isn't that consistent with the state's theory that she was putting the police off their search for him, that in effect helped to conceal his whereabouts and therefore wasn't just germane to her where she was and what she was doing? It was therefore I don't have information about him when she did.
Well, I think it can be read that way, but I don't think that's what the Budik case says. I think the Budik case says if you give a false disavowal about your own participation or whereabouts or whatever, that doesn't count. And I would point in Budik to the false fact that the defendant in that case gave. He said that he was leaning over at the time of the shooting in that case. He was shot at very close range in a car, and his companion, the driver of the car, was killed. He himself was severely injured. He said, I was leaning over to get a beer at the time of the shooting, and I didn't see anything. Now, they knew, or they at least strongly suspected, that was not true because of the way he was shot, where the injuries were. That was a false statement. It was, technically it was an affirmative statement because it wasn't true, and it was saying something, he had done something that was not true. But that was accepted as insufficient to qualify as rendering criminal assistance, and that's the same thing we have here. The facts here are a little bit similar to the Clifford case cited by the Budik case. The Clifford is an Oregon case in which the defendant saw a murderer and a young boy who had been taken by the murderer shortly after the killing happened and later told police, no, I didn't see him, or I haven't seen him in a long time. Those are the exact kind of statements that she made in this case. I haven't seen him, I didn't see him in a long time. And in Clifford, the evidence was found insufficient. The statement that she went to Belfair is the kind of statement that supports her disavowal. If she had said, I was in the car with him and I didn't see him shoot and he never shot anyone, that would be different because that would be an affirmative statement about his conduct. She was merely making statements about her own whereabouts, her own conduct, nothing to do with where he was, whether he killed anyone, and so forth. And again, the statement that she did not see him at the house is different from saying he was not at the house. So
what she, in your interpretation, Did she commit a crime, just only a different crime than the one that was she was charged or convicted of?
Yeah, well, she actually was charged also with giving a false statement, and we have not challenged that on appeal because I think she did do that, and that's the crime that she did.
Okay.
I see my time is up. I'll reserve the rest of the time.
Excuse me. Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Jeremy Morris from the Kitsap County Prosecutor's Office here on behalf of the state, asking this court to affirm the conviction below. I think there's a couple things about Budick that are worth pointing out. Counsel mentioned the fact that the defendant in Budick had said, I don't know anything about who the shooter was, but also mentioned that he had been leaning over and couldn't see it. But that fact was not one of the ones relied on in Budick. And if you look at the opinion at page 740, note 5, the Supreme Court actually says the state did not rely on that statement about him leaning over as a support for the conviction and that the court wasn't considering it. That wasn't before the court. What they based the opinion in Budick on was the statements, I don't know who the shooter was. I don't know who shot myself and the person sitting next to me. So Budick is a clear case of I don't know, I don't know, I don't know. That's the mere false disavowal of knowledge. And if you look at what the Supreme Court does in Budick, they cite repeatedly the California case, which is Pling Sang Tip, I'm sure I'm mispronouncing
that. Yeah.
Yeah. But if you look at what happens, and the Supreme Court, I think it's important when they go through the legislative history, then they go through these other out-of-state cases, and then they ultimately conclude that they find the foregoing interpretations illuminate the meaning of the statute, and they immediately right there cite again to the California case and quote it, which says, affirmative statements of positive facts are distinguishable from a mere disavowal of knowledge. If you look at that California case, what happened in that case, which the court cites to repeatedly, is there's the defendant in that case is in a small office in a food factory of some sort in California, and a murder is committed, and the evidence is he was there when it was committed. Not that he committed it, but that he likely saw it or certainly knew about it. And the defendant's only statements to the police in that case were that he never saw the victim come to the office that day, and he didn't see anything unusual. Those are the only statements. He didn't say, I didn't know anything. He said, I didn't see the victim there. Exactly like what we have in this case, and I didn't see anything unusual. And the California case said those were not mere disavowals of knowledge. Those were affirmative statements of positive fact. And that's the case that our Supreme Court relied on so heavily in Budick and cited repeatedly and quoted those specific passages. So I think you have to say there's, you know, it doesn't take much. But if you have a case where you just say, I don't know, I don't know, I don't know, sure, that's a mere disavowal of knowledge. But if you make a positive statement, if you actually open your mouth and say something, which is what one of the quotes from the California case says, then the statute comes into play. And here,
does there have to be an element of intent to render assistance to that particular person as opposed to an affirmative statement that protects yourself from being implicated?
Sure, the state has to prove that as an element of the crime, that there's an intent to prevent, hinder, or delay. But I think that the fact that
because
a statement...
I think the implication of counsel's argument is that when she... you know, talked about being in Belfair, she was protecting herself.
And I think that may well be, but there, it doesn't, just because you're acting out of self-interest doesn't mean you're not also acting out of an intent, an interest to protect the other person. I mean, they're not mutually exclusive. And that's really a question for the jury, right? I mean, what was her intent there? And I think you're right, you know, by covering Mr. Blake, she's also covering herself because, of course, she was with him when this murder occurred. But the question is, you know, did her statements do more than that? I mean, did they also cover for Mr. Blake? And I think a reasonable jury could find that they did. I mean, we know, and it's understood.
And how they would find that they did was by what thought pattern? In other words, if she, but for her statement that she was in Belfair, I mean, if she had done what? I mean, did she? She didn't, like, put them off the trail. They were deprived of any knowledge that she might have about where this guy might have gone. So then what happened? I mean, I guess they left that place and eventually found him, right?
Correct. Later that morning, I believe, a few hours later. But and I guess...
without any help from her.
Correct. But I think the thought pattern, if I can follow the question, I think what is this. We know that when the police went there, to the Sydney residence where they contacted the defendant, that they were actively, frantically searching for Mr. Blake.
Right.
They did not know where he was. And common sense tells you when you try and when police or anyone is trying to find where someone is currently, one of the questions you always ask is, well, where have they been? Where are their tracks? You know, where can we follow a sequence of events? And if we can figure out where they were and where they went from there, can we find out where they are currently? I mean, that's just common sense, I think. And her statements essentially work to cover those tracks. We know now that she had been with Josh Blake at Josh Blake's residence, that they left there, that the murder occurred when they were pulled over on their way to another residence, that Mr. Blake ditched his truck there, left with two other people, and that the defendant was aware of all these facts. But she covers those tracks. I don't know Josh Blake. I was somewhere else. I came back to the residence by 11 o'clock in one of her statements, well before the murder even occurred. I mean, does that protect herself? Sure, but it also covers the tracks of where Josh Blake has been, what he's been doing in the hours and the minutes leading up to that murder, what he's been doing after the murder, and where he is now. Does she say he's at Disneyland or give some affirmative statement? In that respect, no, but she's covering her tracks, which is what you do when you conceal someone. I think
she doesn't have an obligation to tell them what she knows, isn't that right?
That's absolutely right. She could have stood mute. She could have said, even though I think it's the statute, I mean, I'm not sure how they get there exactly, but I mean, she could have said, I don't know anything, and we'd be stuck. But she didn't say that. She says she didn't know Josh Blake three times, which is different in and of itself than I don't know anything about a crime. I mean, she's denying knowing that person at all, which is a little bit different than just saying I don't know anything about the crime. But even leaving that aside, because I don't think the court has to go that far, she said affirmative false statement about where she had been that night, that she had been in Belfair helping a friend move, that she didn't know who Josh Blake was, that she had returned back to the Sydney house by 11 p.m. We know the murder occurred sometime closer to between midnight and 1 a.m., and that she had not seen Josh Blake at the house. That's exactly the same statement we have in the California case, where the defendant had said he had not seen the victim at the office. And that case was relied on heavily, and that's exactly what her statements are.
How about Clifford?
I think in Clifford, I don't think that it goes into as much detail as the California case. Budick mentions it once, as opposed to the California case where they rely on four or five times and quote it extensively, especially in their findings. I think the actual only citation that he had not seen a murder suspect is a little bit different, and I can't give you the exact factual outlines there. But I think it's pretty clear from Budick where our Supreme Court is relying on. And that is, you know, if you look at even after they discuss the Oregon case, they turn right to their conclusion. And both times they don't cite the Oregon case. They cite the California case. And we find the foregoing interpretation illuminates the meaning. CF, plain thing tip, quote, affirmative statements of positive facts are distinguishable from a denial of knowledge that a crime occurred. So I think it's indisputable that it's pointing us right towards that. But we have even more statements than just, I didn't see him. We have her false statements about where she was, which covered the tracks about where Mr. Blake had been that night.
Exactly how did it cover the tracks? I mean, what happened? If she didn't say, you know, he was here, but I actually saw him going south as opposed to north. You know, I mean, they were left after they talked to her in the same position that they were in when they arrived. Isn't that right? I mean, they didn't know where he was, and after they talked to her, they still didn't have any idea where he was.
Correct, but they also had false information about where she had been, which
and
they did not
have. How was that material? In other words, how did that change the way they thought about what they were going to do next?
Well, I don't have to show that it changed their behavior that way. I have to show that she made a statement to conceal him. I mean, I think what the fact of the matter is, the relevant information, I mean, the information that everyone was looking for was that Josh Blake had been with the defendant. They had been at his house in Gorst, had been pulled over by the trooper, Josh Blake had killed Trooper Radulescu, and they had left and gone to the Sydney residence where the defendant had abandoned his truck and left with two people, Nelson and Bartlett, I believe, and then had left from there. That's the critical information, right, about how, if they were going to track him down and find him, that's the information
that's
they would want.
No, uh-huh.
She covers those tracks. She doesn't know Josh Blake. She wasn't with him earlier. She doesn't know anything, never met him in her life. She was, in fact, somewhere else. She was back at the house well before the murder occurred, and that she had not seen Blake there at that residence. I mean, those cover those tracks. It muddies the water.
How did they finally find him?
You know, the record in this case doesn't reveal that. I believe he ultimately ended up, he got a ride, and they got another ride to someplace else, and then was making phone calls, some frantic phone calls, trying to get a ride out of the area, and I think one of those people had pointed them. I'm seeing my time is up, but had pointed him in that direction. They ultimately ended up in the residence. Certainly was not anything the defendant said.
Thank you.
The police here were in no different situation from if she had kept her mouth shut. She made no false affirmative representations regarding Josh Blake. She made false representations regarding herself. She covered her own tracks, but she did not cover his tracks. The police were left in the same position as they would have been had she kept her mouth shut. There's no affirmative statement here that misled them.
Well, I mean,
or concealed him.
But I'm not sure that the questions I was asking, I think are interesting questions, but I'm not sure that they are material. I mean, counsel argues that this was an affirmative statement of an untrue fact. And it was, wasn't it? I was in Belfair.
Yeah, but it's not a statement made to conceal him.
But isn't that a jury question, whether it was or wasn't? I mean, in other words, what did she intend by doing that? Clearly it helped her to avoid further interrogation, at least at that particular point.
Well, it's not just the question.
But it seems like, you know, I mean, and it seems, though, that she was a friend of Blake. So it isn't the jury entitled to infer that in saying that she knew they were after him and that she wanted to do everything that she could to avoid them catching him?
Well,
give them time to get away.
Two responses. First, the question of her intent is not the only question. The other question is, does she actually harbor or conceal him? So there has to be some effect. It has to be, you know, successful in some sense, because the crime requires proof that she actually harbors or conceals. In addition, the focus of her statements is all about herself. She's not saying, I was there at the crime scene and he didn't shoot him, or I didn't see a shooting, or I didn't see the trooper, or anything like that. That's what distinguishes this case, well, one of the things that distinguishes this case from Plain San Tip. The defendant in that case said, I was there, I was in the minivan where the body was presumably disposed of, I was all around in that minivan, I was present that afternoon, and I didn't see Garcia, and I didn't see Kim murder Garcia, and I am surprised. I would be very shocked to find that Kim was involved in such a heinous crime, and Kim is a good person. So all the statements, I think the magistrate in that case said the totality of those statements shows an intent to conceal, and that's something we just simply don't have here, even when you take into account her graffiti that she wrote months later or sometime later.
Do you agree with the state that the California case is a case that we're entitled to look at and to compare the facts of that case to the facts of this case in reaching our conclusion?
Not entirely. I mean, the Buda case did cite the California case, but the California case was about a preliminary hearing, and the determination there is simply, is there probable cause to proceed with the charge? So the court decided there is probable cause to proceed with the charge and then listed all the things that the jury would have to decide. Did not make a determination that the evidence was sufficient for a finding of guilt. So I think in that sense, Plain San Tip is distinguishable. And I would also argue that the Buda case did not rely quite that heavily on Plain San Tip. I mean, it cites a number of other cases. Clifford cited twice. There's a Tipton case from Texas that's cited. I mean, the Buda case is talking about a number of cases from a number of different jurisdictions to reach its result. So when you look at the facts of Budick, it's distinguishable. When you look at the fact that it was a probable cause determination, it's distinguishable. And when you look at the other cases, like the Clifford case and the Tipton case, you can see that Plain San Tip is not the only case that the court relied upon. If there's no further questions, I think I'm done. Thanks.
Thank you, Tim. Next up is State versus Kristen.